Mecca. So this is the first, I mean, action of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Somehow he's going to be away from initiating a war. That is why he goes to the city of Mecca. Imam alayhi salam stays in the city of Mecca, and on the 8th of Dhul Hijjah, which is the day people, the Hujjaj, the pilgrims are getting ready for going to the land of Arafat, to the astonishment of all the Muslims in Mecca and in Hajj rituals, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam leaves the city of Mecca because he has come to know that Yazid ibn Muawiyah has sent 30 agents to assassinate Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam during the Hajj ritual. So Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam does not want to the sanctity of Mecca to be violated by these people. He does not want the sanctity of the month of Dhul Hijjah to be violated. So on the 8th of Dhul Hijjah, which is very, surprising for the people, so it's very close to beginning of the rituals of Hajj, but Imam Hussein alayhi salam leaves the city of Mecca and he heads toward the city of Kufa because he has been invited. Again, another action of Imam Hussein alayhi salam refraining from initiating a war. So he is going to go toward the city of Kufa. On the way, he is stopped by the army of Hur.
On the basis of the invitation that has been done from him.
Yeah. So on the way, he is stopped. And you know the story of what happened between Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and Hur ibn Yazid al-Yahi. And Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam somehow was forced to go to the land of Karbala. It's been proved in the historical books that it was the army of Hur ibn Yazid al-Riyahi who forced Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam to change his direction and to go to another direction, which led to him coming to the land of Karbala. Again, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam does not begin the war in the month of Muharram. They come to the land of Karbala on the 2nd of Muharram. Mm-hmm. Now, let's see what happens during these 8-9 days. Did Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam begin the war? And with the army of Umar ibn Sa'd, which was sent by Yazid ibn Muawiyah, or not? Again, according to the historical sources, Umar ibn Sa'd, the commander of the army of Yazid, he wanted to begin the war on the 9th of Muharram, which is known as the day of Tasu'a. It's been mentioned that, again, Imam Hussein alayhi salam tries his best to prevent a war taking place, at least in the month of Muharram, which is forbidden for Muslims to fight. It is mentioned that Imam Hussein alayhi salam sent a messenger to Umar ibn Sa'd. In that message, Imam Hussein alayhi salam talked about the verses according to which fighting in the month of in Haram month, including Muharram al-Haram, is forbidden. He sent one of his brothers toward Umar ibn Sa'd that it is forbidden for the Muslim to fight in these months, and this is Muharram al-Haram. Mm-hmm. And it is against the explicit verse of the Noble Book of Quran. Imam emphasizes on the fact that I'm not fearful of death. Rather, I'm reminding you of the fact that what you are going to do is against the explicit text of the Quran, asking Muslims not to fight during the 4 month known as Haram month. So we know that the day the fight was delayed. Again, on the day of Ashura, we know that Umar ibn Sa'd, he addressed his army and asked them to initiate the war and attack the army of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Not only that, he threw an arrow to somehow boast of the fact that he has begun the war. Mm-hmm. And even he mentioned, addressing his soldiers, that be witness before Yazid or before Ubaydillah ibn Ziyad that I was the one who threw the first arrow toward Imam al-Hussein.
So, Sheikh, sorry for the interruption. Let me stop you and ask you a question related to this point that you are talking about. Supposedly, they didn't want to care about what Islam says and what the Islamic principle was in this regard concerning not to start a war. But Imam knew Islam well and he was familiar with these Islamic principles. So why didn't he leave the scene to go back to, I don't know, to be back to his home, to be back to, I don't know, to Mecca or Medina in order to prevent the war?
This is a very good question. The answer is that Imam tried to do that. Mm-hmm. Even Imam asked Hurrem bin Yazid al-Riyahi to let him go to another direction, go to the city of Mecca or Medina, Kufa, any other place, but they didn't let Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. It was a very explicit command by Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad toward Umar ibn Sa'd that you need to fight Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and kill him and send me his head. And we know that for some times Umar ibn Sa'd was hesitating, and then Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad sent another letter that if you are hesitating, then another person would be the commander of the army. And so Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam has no choice but to defend himself. Mm-hmm. And this is mentioned in the Quran in chapter Baqarah verse 194. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, "Ash-shahr al-haram bi-shahr al-haram."
Yeah.
A sacred month for a sacred month, wal-hurumatu qisas, and all sanctions requires, and all sanctities require retribution. So the message of the verse is that all the Muslims need to take care of these sanctities. The fact that they need to be away from fighting during these 4 months. But if other people begin the war, then you have all the right to do what we call it qisas, or kind of retaliation and retribution. I mean, Islam does not tell any person that if during, for example, the month of Rajab or the Hajjah or the Qada or Muharram, some people attack you, then you need to stand still and let them just kill you. This is against the fact that Islam emphasizes much on the importance of life of all human beings. So all the people need to protect their life when they are attacked. Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam tried his best to be away from war, but he was forced based on the historical accounts.
Thank you very much, dear Sheikh Mustafa. Based on your beautiful explanations, you understood and learned that Imam started to prevent this war even from the time that he was in Medina on his way to Mecca, the time that he was performing his Hajj, and mm-hmm. the time from his Hajj towards Kufa or Iraq. He tried his best not to start any war. He did his best in order to prevent any war, but unfortunately the other side insisted on having such a thing. Even at the time that they wanted to start, he asked to be back to his home, to his hometown, but again they did not accept. So Imam kept the values which were in Quran and in Hadith concerning the haram, or let's say forbidden preventions which have come to us from a divine source, but unfortunately the other side did not take care, did not look at these values and virtues. Many thanks, Sheikh Murtada, for your explanations, and your respected listeners for listening to the end of this show. Once again, I'd like to thank you for staying tuned with Q&A on Islamic Beliefs, and I'd like also to invite you to join us in our upcoming sessions. Till then, I'll leave you in Allah's protection. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Inna fil jannati nahran laban. Inna fil jannati nahran laban. Ali wa Husayni wa Hasan. Ali wa Husayni wa Hasan. إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن حب آل البيت فرض
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is your host, Musa al-Bahadili, and you're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing, where we discuss problems, issues, and questions parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. We stress that all of the answers are based upon the Holy Quran and the narrations of the household of the Prophet or the Prophet himself, of course. Joining us in our studio is our guest speaker, Sayyid Abdullah al-Musawi, who is an Islamic researcher at the Islamic Seminary of Qom. Dear Sayyid, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sayyid. Sayyid, our topic today is communication. How should we as parents maybe talk or convey a message or just generally communicate with our children, because this is a very, very sensitive issue and subject. Dear Sayyid, please enlighten us.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa Ali Muhammad wa ajil farajah. It's not just children, it's with every human being or anything that's living. At least we can say it, or with the exception of plants, but yes, even with animals, there has to be a process of communication where you have an idea or you have something to say or something to, you know, at least an order that you want to give, and you want to convey that to someone else. The method of conveying this information to someone else is what we call communication.
Right.
And communication obviously is a two-way tool. It's not a one-way tool.
It's a two-way street.
If I'm just giving you things and I'm expecting you to do things, this is not communication. This is just me giving you orders. To communicate, it means to give and take, to give, receive, and give. So to say, it's like a phone. When you talk on the phone, there's, you know, two ways. So right, this is what communication means. And so obviously, this is my own simple definition of communication. When we use communication with children, it becomes very vital, because most parents, sadly, as always, don't understand how to communicate with their kids, or at least they don't have the skills to communicate with their kids.
I don't have the skills.
And what they end up doing, they either end up dealing with the child based on threats, or they're trying to criticize them, or I don't know, they try to scold them, or like in a way where it is, they're using the
negative communication, negative
threat,
language,
which is not like this is not a communication at all. Which in return, obviously, it will make the child in a defensive mode.
Right.
And once he's in defense mode, sometimes he attacks back, depending on his how he's being brought up.
Well, adults do it as well, so why should not a child?
Exactly. Exactly. So if we do it as adults, obviously we should expect that to as children. And then you have a lot of parents complaining, why is my child talking back to me? Why is he arguing with me?
He's disrespectful to me and all that stuff.
Yeah, why is he doing this and that? Obviously, because there's a break in communication. Even with adults, even with, for example, in marriages, most marriages fail because they lack
the lack of communication.
You might find it always one way, one side. So one either the husband wants things done his way, or the wife.
Or vice versa, yes.
Or vice versa. And then you have this marriage breakdown. Same thing happened with kids. So communication is absolutely vital if we want to get to the heart and the mind of the child. So if and you can see this across different nations. So I can see that we're almost going to a break, so let's leave it up to here.
Yes, dear Seda, I must interrupt you. We will just take a quick break.
I am a Muslim, Islam my deen. Allah my Lord, His word Quran. Muhammad Prophet, peace be upon him.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Islamic Upbringing. We were just talking about communication and communication breakdown in children, because it is, in essence, the same communication breakdown we see in the life of adults and even in marriage. Said, please elaborate further.
So far we said it's a big mistake that parents make, or anyone in this matter make, when they use the method of threats and criticizing and scolding people, or trying to
just putting people
down. Stopping people from to do things as a language of communication. That's a massive problem with anyone, and this becomes even more devastating if we are using it with our children. So before the break, I was about to say that if you look across different cultures or different societies, you will see that the difference is very visible in kids. For example, in nations where the parents they use communication in a proper manner, you see their kids a lot smarter,
more developed.
They speak at a very early age. They are more respectful towards their parents or towards other people. If you compare that to, I mean, I don't want to name names because
we're not going to name any countries.
Some people might take offense to. If you look at other countries, for example, other cultures where the parents is always, he thinks this is my way or the highway.
An iron fist, basically.
Yeah, an iron fist. You can see that the children are, they themselves are very harsh, very hard. You know, they adopt that kind of ideology. And sadly, even in our Islamic society, we see this trend. Because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, He did emphasize and He did impose the fact that the child has to be respectable to his parents, right? This is a must, right? So Allah, in many times of the Quran, He says, worship me and be good to your parents. This is like a repeated order in the Quran.
Yes, many times.
And parents use that as a leash, as a leash on their kids. Don't talk back to me. This is, Allah wouldn't like it. Don't do this. Allah wouldn't like it. I mean, yes, sure. I know Allah doesn't like
it. We agree, but...
But you need to communicate with me, right? You need to tell me what's going on, what's happening. I can't just force you into things and say, okay, Allah said you have to respect. And a lot of kids, even in Islamic society, they become disobedient to their parents. I know I've heard stories of people that even end up bashing their parents or hitting their parents.
Doing
a lot of things, because they just don't know why. You can't just tell them because Allah said so. Even Allah in the Quran, it should be enough.
But this is a child who does not understand such concepts.
Absolutely, like I'm saying, even if you look at the Hadith or the Quran itself, Allah didn't say just do it because I am your Lord and I have power and I can grill you, like a barbecue out of you, if you don't listen to me. He doesn't do that. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala always reasons. And even when he talks to the kuffar or the non-believers, he says, قُلْ هَاتُوا بُرْهَانَكُمْ كُنْتُمْ صَادِقِينَ.
Exactly. Islam is a religion of reasoning.
That's it. Give me a proof, give me a reasoning, and then we'll see what happens. If I get to agree that you've done your search and you've reached this conclusion that there is no God, obviously I can't hold you accountable because you've done your search. So even Allah says, when we have to teach our kids and we use that method of threats and criticism, or inshallah we'll discuss them later in more detail.
Inshallah.
And we end up the discussion, this is not a communication. This is just me being an authoritative place and just giving authority and nothing else. And if this is how I communicate with my children, then expect this child not to become a very fruitful one.
Dear Sayyid, I must interrupt our discussion yet again because we are going on a quick break.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, honor your children and teach them good manners.
Dear listeners, welcome back to our program, Islamic Upbringing. Our topic today is communication and how vital communication is basically in every relationship, but also how much more important it is for a developing child. Dear Sayyid, please elaborate further.
So when we look at communication, we should look at it as not an option or something is good to be done with our children.
You have this strength forward in communicating.
Yeah, exactly. We need to look at it as something absolutely vital, because the way you talk makes a huge difference. The way your body language moves makes a lot of difference. The tone of your voice makes a lot of difference. Inshallah, as later on we will talk about the statistics and how each varies. So everything about you, the way you talk or the way you communicate, makes a difference. The way you look at the child, because it's also a form of communication, because even Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says in the Quran, wa in likulli humazatin lumaza. So sometimes you don't have to talk. You could just point, or you could wink, or you could do something that indicates to other person. For example, when he gets angry and he just points his finger and then he starts to shake it, that's a communication.
Body language, we have this concept.
Exactly. So that's a way of communicating with me, telling me that I'm going to get you once I'm done.
Yes.
So I.
Or with the eye, with the sting eye, you know.
That's it. So you get threatened just by the body language and how they communicate a piece of information to you. So everything makes a huge difference in the life of the child, and especially in the psyche and the mind and the mentality of the child, that a parent needs to be aware of. It's not just saying, whatever happens. I mean, if, for example, if a mother wants to cook a meal, she doesn't bring the ingredients and just dump them in a pot and put them on a fire and expect, farma sabzi to be done by herself.
Exactly.
It's not going to happen.
Some miracle will happen in this
process. Yeah, so there's a process. You have to get the oil, this and that. Then you end up with a soup or rice or whatever you were cooking. Same thing with a child. It's a process of communication. It has to begin with the nice. Even Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, he talks about the concept of al-kalima tayyiba. And he says it's like a tree, that the roots are so deep in the ground and the branches are so up. Just a good word. So when you use the method of communicating, talking to the child, just talking itself, just trying to listen to a child and talk, you are trying to give him respect. You're making him feel that he's needed. He's wanted, he's loved, respected. He feels as he's part of the family itself.
Exactly. Treat them as a human.
Yeah.
As you would like to treat
exactly.
yourself.
Exactly. So he develops his personality through the way you communicate with him. And in some societies and some cultures that we see, sadly, the parents, even when they talk to their children, they use awful words, or they use animal words, like get up, you this, and sit down, you that. And
they curse and curse.
Yeah, and like, this is not communication. So Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, when he gave us children as a trust, as an amana, he expects me to deal with it correctly. And as parents, the first thing that we need to learn is how to communicate in a proper loving, correct manner with our kids.
It is vital.
Because we, obviously, if you do it, it might be a bit of, for a lot of parents, because like they are impatient, it might be like a grueling process, like why should I sit and talk to him and listen to him when I could just tell him what to do and he has to do it,
right?
But at the end of the day, as you grow older yourself and the child grows older, you will need these children to take care of you, right? And depending on how you raise them, they will take care of you. Because a lot of kids these days, they can't wait to send their parents to, what do they call them, retirement homes?
Yes.
And disability homes.
Retirement homes.
Yeah,
retirement. Or they're excited to just grow up and leave their parents' house and live on their own.
Exactly. So like either leave, to say the least, and then just leave their parents and don't want to come back. And that's a result of parents not communicating very well with their kids from a young age. So this is an investment, not just for the child, but also for you as well when you're older.
Yeah, like parents, you will also reap the benefit. So straight up, basically.
Yeah.
They will say that I must unfortunately end our discussion for today because our program's time is up. Dear listeners, this has been your host, Musa Al-Bahadili. Thank you for joining us on our program. If, as usual, you have any questions, comments, or just suggestions, then please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir, and you can also visit our website, parstoday.com. Until another program, take care of yourselves, and Allah bless you all.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest.
Communicate.
An international scandal has erupted after Pegasus, a weapons-grade piece of software used to hack and spy on mobile phones, has been found on the phones of journalists, lawyers, opposition figures, and potentially some of the world's biggest leaders. NSO Group, the Israeli company that manufactures and sells Pegasus, denies these allegations and claims it only sells software to vetted governments for counterterrorism and national security purposes. However, new research by a group of 17 media outlets called Project Pegasus shows an entirely different story. And this unregulated weapon has been used to illegally target, spy, and in some cases, murder journalists and dissidents. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. On July 18th, 2021, news broke of a major phone hacking scandal involving the mobile phones of journalists and some of the world's most prominent politicians. A series of stories were published by Project Pegasus, a collaboration between outlets such as The Wire, The Guardian, and PBS, showing how countries like Mexico, the United Arab Emirates, and Morocco had all purchased an Israeli-manufactured spyware called Pegasus in order to hack the phones of government critics and political opponents. In collaboration with Forbidden Stories, Amnesty International, and researchers at Citizen Lab in Canada, these media organizations went through a list of over 50,000 phone numbers suspected to be victims of the Pegasus spyware. Over 80 journalists working in 10 countries pieced together this puzzle, putting names to numbers, and then went through the arduous process of asking suspected victims to provide their phones for forensic analysis. Traces of Pegasus were found on the phones of numerous journalists, some of whom worked at the very same outlets breaking the story. The investigation identified 180 journalists in 20 countries purported to have been selected for potential targeting, in addition to the phone numbers of French President Emmanuel Macron, Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan, former Lebanese Prime Minister Hariri, and Morocco's King Mohammed VI. Emblematic of the scope of this release, a headline in the Washington Post that read, quote, "On the list, 10 prime ministers, 3 presidents, and a king." Needless to say, this immediately caused international outrage after learning that his phone, along with those of 14 other French government officials, had been potentially compromised. French President Macron immediately convened a national security meeting, and that was followed by an announcement from the chief of the EU Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, calling the hacking completely unacceptable. And of course, this isn't the first time Pegasus is in the news either. Perhaps the most infamous incident involving the Israeli spyware was its use in the murder of the Saudi journalist and dissident Jamal Khashoggi. In February of this year, the United States Office of the Director of National Intelligence, led by Avril Haines, issued a report in which it found that the Saudi Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, was behind the murder of Khashoggi at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul in late 2018. Now, while the DNI report didn't specifically mention Pegasus, it did implicate the entourage and personal security detail of MBS in the killing of the U.S.-based Washington Post columnist. It was long suspected that Pegasus had been used to track Khashoggi's movements in the lead-up to his murder. We now have the hard evidence to back this up. Using the latest forensics, Project Pegasus was able to scan the phones of Khashoggi's fiancée and wife and uncover traces of the spyware on both of their phones. An older report also showed that Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos had his phone hacked just a few months prior to the murder, around the same time as Khashoggi's wife, in 2018. It's alleged that MBS hacked his phone by sending him something over WhatsApp, and the connection here being that Jeff Bezos had bought the Washington Post, the very paper for which Khashoggi wrote before he was murdered. Pegasus was then again in the news, involving another incident in late 2020, when Citizen Lab discovered that 36 journalists at Al Jazeera had had their phones infected with it. Now, Pegasus can be deployed on both iPhones and Androids, and basically works just like a jailbreak or root. It bypasses iOS or Android security and gives the attacker access to the root file system. The attacker can then turn on the microphone, the camera, track the victim's location, see their files, photos, videos, and contacts. It gives them complete access and control, the ramifications and dangers of which are obvious to all. Now, what makes Pegasus so dangerous is that it doesn't even require the user to do anything. In some versions, people would be targeted by a phishing attack. They receive an SMS or an email which looked legitimate, saying, for example, that a package was being delivered to them. They'd click on the link, and then their phone would be infected. Now, Facebook, which owns WhatsApp Messenger, sued NSO Group for using an exploit in WhatsApp to deploy their spyware. The victim would do nothing. They would simply receive a missed call on WhatsApp, and their phone would be infected. Now, however, there are versions of Pegasus that are completely zero-click, which don't require any user interaction, and also whose execution cannot even be seen. Everything happens in the background. Another very frightening aspect of Pegasus is its persistence. In some versions, once the phone was hacked, simply turning off the device and turning it back on would be enough to shut down the hack, at least until a new infection. However, new evidence shows that persistent versions of Pegasus do exist, which penetrate so deeply inside the phone's security that the phone remains hacked even after rebooting the device. This, just like the various attack vectors and exploits, can vary from version to version, and there's no real way of knowing. Joining me is independent journalist Kabir Agarwal. He has written for The Times of India, Al Jazeera, and is now with The Wire, which is one of 17 publications involved in Project Pegasus. Thank you so much for coming on the program, Kabir. It's really a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you. Thank you for calling me and for your interest in the subject.
Kabir, your publication, The Wire, is one of 17 who are part of Project Pegasus, and you guys have been doing fantastic work. Some of your own colleagues are in this list of people that were targeted by Pegasus. The founding editor, M.K. Venu, Bar Darajan, your diplomatic editor. I mean, what was your guys' reaction when you found out this shocking news, and how did it feel for you also to be in the middle of it as you were at this conference in Paris on behalf of The Wire?
Yeah, I mean, the first time that The Wire learned of this was through when they found out, when the founding editors and the diplomatic editor found out that they were themselves on the list. And they actually also went in for the forensic analysis of their phones, and infections were found on the phones of the founding editors. So I think they were shocked. They were not surprised. They were not surprised because they tend to expect this to be the case, that somebody is listening. That is the sad reality of India today, that journalists who are just doing their job expect a certain level of surveillance. So that wasn't surprising for them. I happened to be in Paris for the meeting which happened in May, where representatives of all the publications were there to just to figure out how to move forward with what we have, and also just to get clarity on what it is that we have and how we present this, the publication schedules, coordinating between 17 media houses from across, in different parts of the world. And they have different audiences, they have different ways of presenting the news as well. So just deciding on embargoes and on the publication schedules, that happened in Paris. So it was very intense in that week because we got this, all the media partners were introduced to the list or the database that the Forbidden Stories had. And that is the time when we first saw it. And that is also the time when we then quickly had to decide, because we couldn't also wait a very long time because of there was a risk of leak. So we had to publish quickly, which was a challenge because we had to do a lot of reporting in a very short period of time and across borders. And due to COVID in India, the COVID situation in India was very, very bad at that time. So it was challenging from that perspective as well. But we finally managed to. But the work is ongoing.
And you know, this news about Pegasus, it's caused a real uproar in India. And it's been reported that numerous opposition figures were also among those who had their phones hacked. I mean, could you maybe break down for the viewers exactly how big of an impact this news has had in India and the consequences that have unfolded in politics and the media?
So this has had a huge impact in India. Perhaps the level of opposition to this in India has been, and it's still ongoing because it's been more than 3 weeks now, and that there is continuous disruption of India's parliament due to this, because the opposition parties are demanding that the government discuss this on the floor of the house in India's parliament, which is the temple of India's democracy. And it has had that kind of impact also because I feel that India stands out in the list of countries which are clients or which we understand to be clients of NSO Group, because the other countries are either authoritarian or semi-authoritarian regimes. India is looked at by the world as the world's largest democracy, and that is the image of India, and that is also how India has been a functioning or thriving democracy for a long time. That has changed slightly in the last 6 or 7 years, but that is still it's still not written in stone that you cannot still call India authoritarian or a semi-authoritarian regime. And for this kind of surveillance to take place in India, that is a big issue for most Indians who understand this, who have access to this information. And also the opposition parties and the news stories landed on the day that the Indian Parliament began its monsoon session, as it's known, during the monsoon period. And this entire session, the opposition has been demanding that the government have a discussion on this, and the government has been refusing to have a discussion, to even talk about it, which is why there has been a disruption of Parliament. The Supreme Court, India's top court, has heard the issue. It will continue to hear the issue. So there are deep rumblings going on in India, primarily because amongst the list of countries, it is the only thriving democracy or somewhat thriving democracy.
You know, NSO, they responded to these allegations, to this very good reporting that you guys have done, and they said that everything is baseless. And they said that this list of numbers compiled by Forbidden Stories was apparently public information. I mean, what do you make of their response to these bombshell revelations that you've just uncovered?
Actually, their response on day one was a bit confused. They were a bit confused because they were probably not expecting this. Then their lawyers got together and sent some letters which were quite threatening, where all of this was included, that this is baseless and this is publicly available information, which it is not, because we have been able to confirm through different sources, through different techniques. So one of the main techniques that we've used, which is the forensic analysis which the Amnesty International team has done, which is able to find the Pegasus infection on phones. And it works primarily on iPhones so far, because that is just the nature of the software, that Androids do not maintain detailed logs of the activity on the phone like iOS does. So it's easier to identify infections or Pegasus related activity. And this methodology, which is used by Amnesty International has been vetted and has been peer-reviewed by Citizen Lab, which has been at the forefront of these forensic analysis in the past as well, which did it for WhatsApp, and WhatsApp revealed that it's a vulnerability in WhatsApp was used to hack several phones around the world. So the methodology of Amnesty International is rock solid, and that is what we can base on, that so many phone numbers which appear in this list have forensic analysis proved that there is infection on these phones. And there would be infections on the Android phones as well, but it's just that we have not been able to find it because of the way the software is there. Maybe in the future, we will be better equipped to find those infections as well. But so those are some of the reasons why we can certainly say that this list is real, and it's not publicly available either.
Is it correct that they've engineered Pegasus in a way that it can delete its own tracks, so it can remove the evidence that it's even infected the phone in the first place, right?
Correct, yeah. It's getting smarter. So the latest, what the Amnesty's tech team has been telling us is that they see these processes which are essentially deleting tracks of Pegasus activity on the phone. Because now NSA has known for a time, because Citizen Lab has been doing analysis. So they have now been also actively trying to delete traces of Pegasus activity. So it's possible that we may not find Pegasus activity on a phone because all the traces have been deleted. So yeah, that is happening too, and they are getting smarter. The people who are analyzing on the other side are also getting smarter. So it's a cat and mouse game in that sense on the tech part.
Kabir, the thing with NSO Group is that the people who founded this company or work at this company, they're not the only ones making cyber weapons or military grade spyware. These are graduates of this Unit 8200, and you know, people, they've talked about this sort of pipeline between this unit 8200 in the Israeli forces and this cyber weapons industry and companies like NSO Group. Is there something else that we know about other companies, or could you maybe tell us more about this so-called pipeline between the Israeli forces and this private sector, this industry?
I mean, I have not done much reporting on Israel and the links there, so I don't know much. I mean, the colleagues who work with Haaretz in Israel, they have done some excellent reporting on this. And I mean, yes, there is that link, and I mean, there is essentially very little separation between, I mean, the Israeli government is also involved, right? So the Haaretz has done this reporting that it was also used like a diplomatic tool, right? So by Netanyahu. So wherever Netanyahu went, NSO went with him, or other Israeli defense equipment also went with him. So these sales were being made. Even in the case of India, Prime Minister Modi visited Israel in July 2017, and it's around that time that we see the first selections being made of potential targets in India. Around the time, so Netanyahu and Modi were walking hand in hand on the beach, and in the background, their teams who were working on this. So we see that Israel has, I mean, at least Netanyahu at least used it in that sense as well. But I mean, there is excellent reporting being done by Haaretz on that.
There's a speculation going on that Israel would never sell this weaponry without being able to know what it's used for, because the claim by NSO is that they have no idea what it's used for. Once they sell it, and they can't confirm whether it's been used to target journalists or not, or they say that they have nothing to do with it. Is that true? I mean, surely the Israelis must know what it's being used for. Do you think there's a possibility that they can use Pegasus to watch what the customer is doing with it?
Yeah, I mean, this is a big question which we've only heard contradictory responses from NSO about this. On the one hand, they claim that they have no control over it. They don't know how their software is being used. On the other hand, they also say that they are sure that their software is not being used for human rights violations. So both of these cannot be true, right? And they've also in the past, there are certain cases which they've said, they have pinpointed that these people have not been targeted using Pegasus. But if they have sold their software and they do not have access to what their clients are doing, how do they know that these people have not been targeted? right? So they must know. And this is a tricky situation because the impression that the client may have also may be that NSO does not know what the client is doing. And this must not be a very easy situation for the client country to be in either. If it knows that NSO has access to what the client has access to, and that in effect could perhaps mean that the Israeli government has access to what the client has access to. And that would be a major security threat, as some opposition leaders in India have pointed that out, that if the Israeli government has access to, and this is serious sensitive information, even if it's being used for anti-terrorist activities in India, and why would it be Indian security agencies want that the Israeli government have access to that information? NSO has not been able to conclusively answer this question. On the one hand, they claim that they don't have access. On the other, they claim that there is no human rights violation. So we don't know.
Just as a last question, Kabir, a two-part question. Do you think we're going to be seeing more of these revelations in the future? And what can people do to protect themselves from such things?
I'll answer the second question first. I don't think there is a lot people can do to protect themselves from such a thing as of now. I mean, one thing we were told initially was that if you have an iPhone, you should switch off FaceTime and iMessage. I don't know if that is any longer true, because I think Apple has come up with a security patch which patches the vulnerabilities which were being used latest. But there will be new vulnerabilities, new zero-day targets which hackers will find. So I don't know if there is anything. I don't think there is anything which users can do. Just keep updating your phone regularly. Perhaps that's it. And in the future, yes, I think that there would be more revelations. More and more people are coming forward, so our work is not over. We are analyzing phones because now people are confident. So initially when we approached some people, they did not want to go through the forensic analysis process. But now that the stories have been revealed and the scale and scope of this has been revealed, people know. So more people are coming forward. We are doing more forensic analysis every day. And we did take a bit of a break for a week or so, but now we are back and they are back working on it. So more revelations will come, for sure.
Well, keep up the fantastic work, the great reporting. Kabir Agarwal, thank you so much for coming on the program. Really such a pleasure speaking with you.
Thanks, Richard. Great talking to you as well.
Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Now, what's interesting about the entire Pegasus affair isn't just the spyware itself, but the history behind the company, too. NSO Group, the Israeli manufacturer, was founded by graduates of Unit 8200, an intelligence and cyber spy agency in the Israeli forces. The thing is, we're not just talking about one company or one piece of spyware here. The Israelis have an entire pipeline of former spies and analysts who leave this unit and others similar to it and then use their knowledge and skills to go form companies which specialize in cyber weapons and cybersecurity. Haaretz reports in 2018 that 700 companies founded by 2,300 Israelis, 80% of whom had come from intelligence units in the Israeli occupation forces, notably Unit 8200. Now, of course, it's true that the Israelis like to exaggerate the allure and mystery around this unit in order to make it seem very special and elite. You'll hear of Unit 8200 mentioned in movies and TV shows, which is part of a marketing gimmick to make the Israelis seem exceptional. Nevertheless, there is some truth to the idea that a pipeline exists between their intelligence units, the military, and cyber weapons industry. Spyware, just like Pegasus, cannot even be sold without the knowledge and consent of Israeli politicians. This shows you that there is a clear link between the cyber weapons industry and the Israeli occupation, which not only trains these founders in the first place, but then helps them export their hacking tools and weapon systems. And if the Western world claims to support democracy and human rights and freedom of press, then it cannot continue to support Israel as it exports tools that are used to target journalists, political opponents, and human rights advocates. This is the antithesis of democracy. Western nations cannot continue to allow Israel to sell spyware that is so overwhelmingly dangerous and used to target dissidents, journalists, and activists. This goes against everything the United States, Great Britain, France, and its allies claim to stand for. It's also important to keep in mind that the things we discover and learn about things like Pegasus are usually outdated by the time we find out about them. And if you think that a commercialized cyber weapon like Pegasus is scary, just imagine what the NSA, GCHQ, and other intelligence agencies are able to do. Now, another major controversy that emerged at the same time as these Pegasus revelations is Apple's plans to scan the phones of its users. Apple claims that in order to fight child abuse, it wants to scan all the images its users upload on iCloud, comparing their hashes with the database provided by the police and the government. Edward Snowden, the former NSA analyst who leaked information exposing mass surveillance by the US government, expressed concern about this development. Apple is seeking to implement this feature in iOS 15. And the thing is, who gets to decide what's in the hash database? Who's to say the United States government won't include photos of classified documents in there and then jail anyone who's found to have matching photos on their devices, including whistleblowers and journalists? The possibilities and dangers that this poses are endless. Now, something amusing you might hear people say online is, how could we do this? These are overwhelmingly Western governments and corporations engaging in these unfettered practices of mass surveillance and are accountable to no one. And the fact of the matter is that Western governments cannot continue to support Israel's war crimes and certainly not its cyber weapons industry. The responsible thing to do would be to ban the sale of such cyber weapons and pressure any entity developing such armaments to cease immediately and entirely. But sadly, many countries that claim to be democracies are engaged in these very practices of mass surveillance, censorship, and putting journalists and whistleblowers in jail. Just look at Julian Assange, look at Chelsea Manning, or even Daniel Hale, who was sentenced just a few weeks ago for exposing the United States' horrific drone program. And given these explosive revelations of tools used to spy on, blackmail, and even kill journalists, with an entire industry dedicated to the development and sale of cyber weapons. And you know, this isn't the first time that Pegasus has made the headlines, and why it certainly won't be the last. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
While the Lambda variant may not be more infectious than Delta, it prophesizes what the future of the pandemic may look like and reveals why it is important to educate the public about how mutant strains work, says Matthew Rosa, writer, in an article titled Lambda Variant Raises Dire Concerns About Pandemics Future Trajectory. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Now, the dominant strain in many countries, the ultra-contagious Delta variant, has torn through unvaccinated communities and even infected some vaccinated folks around the United States. Far from a surprise, this scenario was predicted back in March by CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky, who said then that her colleagues had a sense of impending doom for the possibility that mutant variants could sweep America. Experts also know that Delta variant is unlikely to be the last mutation. Viruses cease mutating for no one. And now another variant appears to be spreading around the world, one that may be even more resistant to vaccines than Delta. It is known as Lambda. People are noticing. Forbes magazine recently ran a story with the title, "It is time to pay close attention to the Lambda variant now devastating South America." On the other side of the equator, at Tulsa, Oklahoma, APC affiliate warned its audience that new Lambda variant could make Oklahoma's COVID situation worse. Headlines regularly tout studies indicating that the variant could be able to evade vaccines, although the articles themselves always note that vaccinated individuals are much less likely to develop serious illnesses that the unvaccinated have. But while the Lambda variant may not be more infectious than Delta, it prophesizes what the future of the pandemic may look like and reveals why it is important to educate the public about how mutant strains work. For biological reasons, virus mutations have a tendency to crop up as vaccination rates rise. As vaccination rates increase and SARS-CoV-2 has fewer people to infect, it inevitably evolves in a way that lets it thrive in new, less auspicious environments. Dr. Jonathan Zenneman, an infectious disease specialist and professor at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, wrote to reporters, "The virus needs to develop ways to increase its transmissibility as there are less targets to infect." He noted, "The regularity with which mutations arise, we have been seeing a progression of increasingly transmissible variants about every 2 to 3 months." In the case of the Lambda variant, health experts' concern is that it appears to resist some of our body's immune responses better than other mutant variants which have emerged. According to Dr. Georges Benjamin, executive director of the American Public Health Association, that plus its higher infectivity puts it on the list of viruses to watch. Should it mutate in a more favorable form for infectiousness or lethality, it could be a real problem, he added. If that happens, scientists would at the very least need to update our vaccines. At this point, Benjamin emphasized the Delta variant is a priority for now, in part because no one can predict the future of the Lambda variant with any accuracy, and it has not presently proved itself to be more infectious than Delta. In the event that Lambda outbreaks happen, we may need to again close schools, businesses, and other facilities to protect people. Benjamin added, "We know a lot more about how to use selected closures, and I hope we use that knowledge." The key to succeeding against the Lambda and all other variants, each of the experts who spoke with reporters agreed, is to stay on top of them. This means monitoring them through regular and rigorous research, and particularly not overreacting, since doing so might send the public the wrong impression about the importance of getting vaccinated. Initial studies in the lab that have yet to be peer-reviewed suggest that the vaccines in current use will remain protective against the Lambda variant. Dr. Russell Medford, chairman of the Center for Global Health Innovation and Global Health Crisis Coordination Center, told reporters by email, adding, "The same studies also demonstrated that current monoclonal antibody therapy will also remain effective." Dr. Nadia Rohan, an associate professor of urology at the University of California, San Francisco, whose work helps identify signatures of infectious and reproductive diseases in humans, said there are promising signs in the existing data. No actual efficacy data available yet, but what's clear thus far from the studies in the lab suggests that T-cell responses elicited by vaccination remain robust against the viral variants to date, Ruan told reporters, referring to the part of the immune system that attacks specific foreign disease-causing particles, also known as pathogens. I don't expect things.